Today on Rockin' the Suburbs,
we check in with Mackenzie Crenshaw, who is now living in Champaign, Illinois,
which is exactly 692 miles from Philadelphia. Okay, Patrick, so this is exciting. This is exciting. I say that a lot, but this time I really, really mean it, okay?
You're very excitable.
I am. I'm an excitable boy.
That's right.
This is exciting. The show is Rockin' the Suburbs. I'm Jim Lenihan.
And I'm Patrick Foster.
And we're going to have a third voice on this show today, and somebody who I think is going to become a semi-regular contributor now to the show.
Cool.
You know her. You love her. Please welcome... big round of applause, Mackenzie Crenshaw.
Thank you. Thank you. There's air clapping going on.
So Mackenzie's been on the show occasionally before. She is a music fan out there in the Midwest, now currently in Illinois in graduate school.
Mm-hmm.
And we've always been impressed with some of the stuff she's brought to the show in the past. She's done a couple of guest episodes, I think, and been a caller on some new music episodes and best ofs and whatever, you know, just stuff like that. And the general audience reaction has always been more Mackenzie, I think, is what it's
yeah,
been.
And I think Mackenzie...
like more cowbell.
May have,
same deal.
Yeah. May have been the first person to recognize that somehow the pandemic created a disco revival.
So, yes. Actually, it
totally
was you.
Did.
It did. I'm really confused about it, too. Actually, I think, Patrick, you said your theory is that everybody just needs an escape.
That's right.
So let's have disco.
I mean, yeah, exactly. That's, you can dance, you know, in your own room to disco as long as you want. So.
Disco Stu likes disco music.
All right. So, Mackenzie, we're going to then task you with coming up with topics you want to talk with us about and present to the world. So, what would you like to talk about today?
Yes, well, somewhat related to disco, tangentially. We're going to talk about Philly Soul, because I think I've constantly been talking about all this new music that's coming out and how it's always sounds like Philly Soul, but I don't necessarily think people know what Philly Soul is or,
right.
You know, that subgenre and where it came from. So, like, I think we should do a little outline about it.
Love it.
Cool.
I think that's good. I think a lot of times, a lot of that music just gets lumped in and people go, that's Motown, right?
Yes,
and it's not
for sure.
The same thing.
When Silk Sonic came out and everybody was like, oh, this is Motown, I said, no, it's not.
Hold on a minute.
Right. Okay, Mackenzie, so start us off with Philly Soul. What would you like to discuss there?
Well, I think we got to start right with Kenny Gamble and Leon Huff, Philadelphia International Records. So Kenny Gamble actually started working when he was like 17. Like, he was signed onto Columbia Records. I don't know if people know that. And that's, I think, where he initially met Leon Huff.
Okay.
And I've never heard any of those singles. Couldn't tell you what they sound like.
Yeah, I don't know.
But he was making music as a teenager.
Yeah, apparently, even like when he was 5 or 6 years old, his family knew that he was going to be a performer. Like, he was recording himself on like little handheld stuff and, you know, always performing every Sunday in front of his family. So
he met Leon Huff when they were very young, and they actually, they were working together in the mid 60s. This I didn't know until recently. The song I'm Gonna Make You Love Me that made popular by the Supremes and the Temptations is actually a Gamble and Huff song.
It's like their first big song, yeah.
Yeah, and I had no idea. Their amazing version, or the version that was initially recorded, was by Jay and the Techniques. You've seen that song, what is it, Apple Peaches Pumpkin Pie? That one? Yeah. But it was this was the song. And that was in 1968. And then kind of from there, everything took off.
Hmm.
So they had, before Philadelphia International Records, which I think most people are familiar with, they had Gamble Records. It was just Kenny Gamble's label. And this is where they had some of their first songs. I think for me, the song that I would like point people to is Cowboys to Girls by the Intruders.
Cowboys to Girls. I remember when I used to play shoot 'em up.
Shoot 'em up.
But I was young and didn't understand.
you've ever heard of it. It's fun.
Yep.
It's
a novelty hit in some ways, right? But also combines some pretty good soul music. What do you think, Mackenzie? These guys, when they got in the business, this was a career you could make money at, right? And you could be successful and you could also express your vision, right? And I think they were visionary enough together to recognize that in each other, but also to learn what the landscape was at the time they were working in the city they were working, right? Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I always say that, like, the 60s was really, like, Motown's reign of terror. Like, if you were not a Motown artist, you were not going to get these hits.
There's something to that. Yeah, right. They controlled it. Yeah, they controlled the distribution.
But I do think on this particular song, like, you can start to hear what we would hear in the 70s, right? Like, those horns, the big, lush string arrangements, the vocal harmonies. I think all of that comes out on that kind of early song.
Totally agree. And just so our listeners get it, Mackenzie, frame Philly Soul and Philadelphia, you know, the classic, I mean, it was used on Soul Train, right, as a theme song at one point. So frame how ubiquitous, right, and how popular it became.
Yeah, so I think, you know, most people think, and I'm one of those people, I think Jim said, you know, a lot of people see soul music as like a monolith, and I'll get very aggravated,
right?
Because soul was actually like very regional, right? Like there was different sounds in different parts of the country.
Yep.
So Philly soul, you can lump it into Northern soul in that it was like very Motown-esque, right? Like it was very polished. There was these really big arrangements, but I mean, if you listen to a Motown song, Jim, I think when you went to the Motown Museum, they talked about this, but like there's like, they use the echo chamber, right?
Yeah.
Where like they'd pipe it in. So when you listen to Motown sounds, like, yes, it's very large, but it's also very echoey.
Right.
But I don't hear that on Philly Soul. I think it sounds much crisper and clearer.
Yeah.
I think that's very true. It sounds a little more polished, right? Not that Motown isn't polished, but it's a different, Motown prided itself on having a bit of urgency to the music. Like it was, it had a little more kind of rock to it, right? The story is always that it was like, it had to sound great coming out of that single AM radio speaker, right? So there was more of a turn the loudness up, you know? And Philly Soul was more, for lack of a better term, it's just more soulful, right?
No, I think it's totally... Yes, because I think Motown, right, was trying to get into the pop market.
Yeah.
Whereas I think Philly Soul was really in the spirit of, like, the Black Power movement of the 70s, right? It was like, no, we have no interest in getting crossover play. We are doing this for, like, R&B audiences.
Yeah, I think that's right. Because it sounds like it's made by kids who grew up, you know, were performing on streets in Philadelphia. Like, that's what it sounds like, right?
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. And Kenny Gamble and Leon Huff, like, they were producing music for soul artists on Mercury and Atlantic, too, in the late 60s. So that's kind of, to Patrick's point, like, that's how it was getting out into the music stratosphere. So it wasn't just stuff coming out on Gamble's label. It was on major labels as well.
Yeah, and that, to me, is one of the most amazing things that they were able to, Gamble and Huff, understand that you could also get paid as a songwriter, as a producer. They began to understand the way the music business worked earlier than a lot of people. You know, I think you're right on, Mackenzie. You know, Motown wanted to appeal to the white, affluent teenager who had money to spend on singles. Not to say that Jim and I didn't have bad taste, but, you know, you're born into a condition where you love music. And if you got the money, I always spent it, right, on Motown records. But, you know, loving both sides of it, I think, is what was amazing to Gamble and Huff. I don't think they necessarily wanted to lessen their vision, but they also, they wanted to get paid as fast as they could get paid. They wanted to get rich. Yeah, they wanted to be the Ekman brothers and run Atlantic Records, for sure.
But within that, 3 to 4 year period where they were producing in the late 60s, like Philadelphia International Records, which most people are going to recognize, that was established in 1971. So like they were getting money very, very quickly.
Yeah. Yeah, that was part of their whole vision.
And they got their distribution deal with CBS.
Right.
When Gamble and Huff ruled, that's when to be hot was cool, to care was correct, To be involved was without examination or explanation because it was just the right thing to do, to creatively express yourself while knowing who you and your people are.
Once Philadelphia International Records was created, like the way they set up the company is very similar to Motown, which is kind of funny. They had a house band, MFSB, which is mother, father, sister, brother. And then they also had, you know, their own producers and in-house arrangers, most famously probably Tom Bell. And then McFadden and Whitehead, right, were like house writers and house producers. So they were very much modeling, I think, themselves after Motown's kind of assembly line system.
Yeah, and Stax, right, McKenzie emulated that to some degree as well.
Yes, for sure. I think that, you know, one is like cost savings. So if you have the same folks, you can save costs. But I think also to very much in like the Motown spirit to maintain the sound that they were going for required them to have the same musicians and the same producers.
I kind of love that. I love it when a label has like a house band. I just love that. There's just something really cool about that. You bring in different singers, different artists, but they kind of all play with the same musicians who are like really great. So it has like different textures, but it's all kind of like built on the same foundation. I don't know. I just think that's really cool. I love that Daptone like continued that tradition.
Agree. You know, yeah, right, totally anyway. Agree. I mean, Muscle Shoals studio.
Well, right? There's that same too.
Yeah. Wrecking Crew in Laurel Canyon.
That's
like,
right.
I mean, I think that in general, like that helps to establish your sound.
It gives a label personality, I think, beyond just being a company, right? It actually has like, it has some soul to it, right? Yeah.
Yeah. So from here, right, like this is what everybody knows, the OJs, the Jacksons, Harold Melvin and the Blue Notes, Billy Paul, like all of those starts coming out. And I mean, I think personally, like they took over the like R&B and soul charts in the 70s as far as what was popular. And I don't know if y'all have some songs you like that are Philly soul-esque, but, you know, the main kind of vibe or like, I guess, the main elements of what we would consider to be Philadelphia soul is, again, these really large arrangements. Usually the songs will have strings and horns on them. And they usually have the rhythms. They usually use hi-hats, which is very unique, I think. In that sound, that kind of hi-hat rhythm. And then the bass lines obviously have a groove because Philly soul would turn into disco, I think. That's my take.
I totally agree, McKenzie, and I think that's super well said. And I think the hi-hat, for me, when you go back and you listen to those records, you know, the ones that caught your ear on the radio, you know, when you're driving with your aunt or something and they just left the radio on and they cut through so well, was that hi-hat. And the hi-hat, combined with the rhythm, is what disco turned up, right? You know, they got the treble knob and turned it up in the mid knob and turned up that hi-hat, and then they just turned the bass up a little bit more, and it was essentially the same formula, right? And the beats per minute went up, but that's kind of the pocket that they established. And I don't know what you think as a student of the advanced higher education, but also the immigration on the East Coast to Philly and New York and Baltimore, right, and D.C. all the way up to that corridor, there was a lot of immigrants and there was a lot of different influences from world music, right, that came into this to this sound.
No, yeah, I would agree. I think that would especially, I think, I know at least Kenny Gamble, I believe, is from Philadelphia. Right. And I think Leon Huff might be as well. But for sure, I mean, I think that they were probably hearing a lot of different sounds. And they would have been that first generation of Black children after the Great Migration. So they're bringing in, you know, songs from the South, gospel music, spirituals, that type of stuff. So they were, I mean, they must have been being like inundated with so much different types of music.
I know. Yeah, really, totally. Yeah. And amazing, similar to the way music, you know, in the late 70s started to cross over too in New York City, beyond punk and all that. So, yeah.
For me, I feel like this is not even a Gamble and Huff song, which we can get into that, right? To your point, Patrick, again, how widespread it was. You had people on other labels emulating the sound. I think, could it be I'm Fallen in Love by the Spinners? Mm. I always point people to that as like, this is like the Philly soul song. Like, if you want to know what it sounds like, so that's good. It.
Since I met you,
So good. I have three things here. Okay. First off, I want to say that as a kid growing up in Toledo, Ohio, and being an hour from Detroit, that I so loved watching Soul Train. And we could get it, I think, on the Toledo station and then get like it played like again on the Detroit station where I could watch it.
But, oh, nice.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And even as a kid, I was just like, Bandstand, that's just Squaresville, you know, Soul Train. It's fake. That's where it's at,
fake,
man.
Yeah. Bandstand was fake.
I loved it. I loved it. So I kind of got some, you know, introduction to some Philly Soul stuff there. Although that wasn't exclusively what Soul Train was all about. As you mentioned, they used the theme song and all that. But second thing I want to talk about, also Ohio related, we got to mention the OJs because they're the pride of Ohio and made their name in Philadelphia. And everybody knows Love Train, of course. Classic song, amazing song, goes in the Hall of Fame as a song. But Backstabbers, that's a song.
Great song. Yeah. Great song. Great song. That's also one of my favorites. Yeah. And I think like the OJs really embodied, like, I mean, I think something important in Philly Souls are like the vocal group.
Yes. And that's what I meant about the streets. Like it had a certain sound of the streets in a way, even though it had all this production and all of that behind it, it harkened back to the vocal groups, right? Which was mostly an East Coast kind of thing. Yeah.
Yeah, the OJs, Harold Melvin and the Blue Notes. Even when you had like Billy Paul, he had like they always had backing vocals. I mean, I think they had, again, similar to all these other companies we've been talking about, right? Like their own backing vocalists along with the different groups they had.
And then my third thing is a question, which is just, Mackenzie, how did you get into this stuff? Like, where did this love of this type of music, where does it stem from?
So people who have listened to the show for a while will know that I am a Motown stan. Do you guys know what a stan is?
It's no. Like a super fan or something like
Yes, yeah. Oh. Okay, the song Stan by Eminem, right? Like it's written by a crazed fan. Some people have adopted the term stan to be like a super fan.
Anyways, I hope you get this, man. Hit me back. Just a chat. Truly yours, your biggest fan. This is Stan.
So Motown was, I think, very similar. I grew up in Ohio. I think that that's just very common to hear Motown. And like when I started collecting records, I mean, my Motown collection is horrendous. Like it's so large. And I think because it was just available.
Yeah.
So initially I was not into really 70s soul at all. And I would say it was really only within the pandemic, actually, that I started paying more attention to the 70s R&B and soul music. I think influenced in part because of a lot of the music that's coming out right now is very much being influenced by this sound.
That's cool.
Totally. Yeah,
and,
totally
and I
agree.
Could see that, you know, it's obviously, like I said, it's certainly closely related. It's not a stretch if you're a Motown fan that you could be a Philly Soul fan or a Stax fan or, you know, the classic Atlantic Records Soul and all that, right? But to then recognize or sort of like do that sort of musical archaeology where you're like sort of like figuring out like where did this really come from and how is it all related and how is it the same and different and all of that, I find just really interesting. And I don't know if you're like me. Nobody's quite like me. But if you are... If you have this where you're like all of a sudden just like for whatever reason decide to get into some subgenre or something that you've never really explored before and then you get like so into it, right? You guys have
Yeah,
had that
I mean I think that
right?
that's what that's No, it's not just you. I think that that's very much kind of I guess what happened with soul in general. I mean, I got really into soul music when I was in undergrad, like I was 18. And you just kind of lose yourself, right? Because during the 60s, everybody was covering each other. And so you find a song and you're like, oh, this must be a cover because this doesn't sound like what I'm used to. And then you just go down the rabbit hole of finding out who covered who and where was this song produced and who played on this song, who produced this song. And the internet has been obviously, I think, very helpful for younger people like me who are interested in falling down the rabbit hole. You look one thing up on Wikipedia and then it's 2 hours later.
That's right.
Yeah, that's true. And I think, you know, it's a great point, Mackenzie, too, about reggae and ska, right? And Jamaican music, same thing, right? It went from the other part of the country.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. It went from the South to Jamaica and through New Orleans and all that. But it's the same kind of process.
Yeah, so I mean, eventually this led into disco, right? You had people like Barry White, who was not on Philadelphia International Records, but like Barry White, some of his first songs were like, there was the singles version, the dance version that was an extra 2 minutes long. There might have been a remix. Like, I, for some reason, heard, I have one of Barry White's albums and I was playing it and Can't Get Enough of Your Love, Babe came on. And now yep. I've listened to it every day. At least three times. I don't know why.
It's a classic. Yeah.
It's just catchy.
It's amazing.
Well, Mackenzie, what would you say if you were going to do a primer for your students, for example? Would it be 20 songs, 50? Like, how would you, you know?
Probably cut? 20.
Okay, probably 20. Cool.
All right.
So, would you be interested in doing that for a suburb?
Absolutely
spot?
Not. Right. No, yeah, I will. I'll make one for sure.
All right, cool. All right, and you're going to be with us at least once a month, I think is the plan.
Yes.
Maybe more often. We'll see how it goes, all right?
Yeah, for sure.
Maybe we can take like 2 weeks off, Jim, and
well, there's that too.
Yeah, just have me do it.
I'm building towards something here. Yeah, but anyway.
Well, let's motives just, you know, eventually yeah. are revealed, yeah.
That's right. Well, this is great. Thank you very much. And like you, I said, Mackenzie, Mackenzie will yeah. be a regular here on the show as we move forward. She obviously has great taste in music and a lot of curiosity, which I think is the most important thing. All right, let's get out of here, though. If anyone else would like to comment on Philly Soul, and we'd love to hear about your own personal experiences with the music, you can call and leave a message 612-440.
I don't remember what it is. I don't work here.
We'll show it.
1984.
There you go. Or you can email rock@suburbspod.com, or you can find us on Facebook or Twitter or Instagram @suburbspod. All right. Mackenzie, would you want to give out your Twitter or anything? You want people to follow you?
My Twitter is @MAC_ATTACK8881. So MacTac8881. I have to hide it from my students. Okay. I also do have like a professional Twitter that is Miss Crenshaw _5. If you look up Mackenzie Crenshaw, it should come up. But yeah.
All right. This has been a delight. So, all right. Now let's get out of here. It's Rockin' the Suburbs. I'm Jim Linehan.
I'm Patrick Foster.
And I'm Mackenzie Crenshaw.
All right. Good. You nailed that one. All right. We'll talk to you all later. My darling, can't get enough of your love, babe. Girl, I don't know why. Can't get enough of your love, babe. Lord, some things I can't get used to, no matter how I try. It's like the more you give, the more I want. And baby, that's no lie. What is the line? I learned more in a 3-minute pop song than I ever learned in school.
Yes. Right?
So
it is.
There you go.
Yeah.